Well, here we are once again in the Record Cafe, where we've been listening to a talk on Yugoslavian football, art, philosophy and many other things with Paul Norcross. We're also joined by Les Hall, formerly of the Sparrow and a fan of Croatia and all things Yugoslavian, to chat about Yugoslavian football and doubtless a million and one other things. So Paul, just briefly, how did you get into Yugoslavia and Yugoslavian football and all that sort of thing?
Well, I suppose got into it, surprisingly, through philosophy. There were a kind of group of kind of philosophers in Ljubljana writing in the sort of the end of the sort of, you know, 90s, beginning of about the year 2000-2001. And I went over to interview one of them, and unfortunately I didn't find him.
You didn't find him?
I didn't find him.
So how did that then lead to spending something like 9 years living in various
parts? I kept trying to find him.
Oh, right. You said something really interesting earlier when you were talking about Trieste and the fact that Trieste had two football teams, one playing in the Italian league, one playing in the Yugoslavian league, but they played in the same stadium.
Yes.
Does that kind of epitomise Yugoslavian football and the complexities of Yugoslavian nationhood and culture and everything else?
Well, I think that's such a peculiar example. I mean, the Trieste thing is quite unique to have I don't know if there's any other equivalent example where you've got a team, a city which where one team's playing in another national league to the other team. I don't know if that exists anywhere else or has existed anywhere else historically. And it was a very one of those things which, because in way the politics of Trieste at that time, it was a fought over territory. You know, the Yugoslavs wanted it, the Italians wanted it. And in a way, football was reflecting that split at the time between sort of communism and an Italian system at that moment. And I think that it's interesting how football does become a kind of diplomatic football, if you like, in that moment. So Tito's ploughing loads of money into Amatori Ponziana, who he sees as kind of sort of representative. In fact, the interesting thing about Amatori Ponziana is when they played in the first Yugoslav League Championship, he actually finished bottom, so he should have been relegated. But Tito didn't relegate them because it was too important to keep them in a top league in order to sort of say that Trieste is part of Yugoslavia. And so you get a whole thing in which you're almost like untouchable. They're a team that can pay wages three times more than any other Italian club because Tito's funding them. Because it matters to the development of the prestige of the new communist order in Yugoslavia, which of course is very. And this is part of the interesting thing with the Allies and Yugoslavia, because there's a sort of suspicion about Tito, because Tito's a communist, and you know, so we don't know. I think, oh, do we support Tito or not? And Tito's also peculiarly placed in, because he also ends up falling out with Stalin in the Russian system, and Yugoslavia go on the kind of third way socialism, if you like, a non-aligned movement. Where they, you know, literally kind of they feel under threat from NATO and the Warsaw Pact. I think Yugoslavia is the only country that doesn't actually join a communist country that doesn't join the Warsaw Pact in that period. And I think football reflects those kind of moments.
Yeah. So Yugoslavia comes from a collection of what?
The Austro-Hungarian Empire is kind of basically running kind of Croatia and Serbia and so on. And but the interesting thing is that when the Austro-Hungarian Empire kind of collapses after the First World War, then what happens then is there's a kingdom of Slovenes, Croats and Serbs formed. And this kind of then becomes a kingdom of Yugoslavia in 1929. And in that period you have like then the birth, if you like, of the idea of Yugoslavia, but not a communist idea of Yugoslavia. You know, it's a different kind of... But all the football clubs are kind of active and born in that period, you know, around the First World War period.
Are the football clubs a classic British sailors roll up somewhere and beginning kicking a ball about and the locals take it on?
Well, yeah, I mean, British sailors rolling up in Rijeka sounds very poetic, and, you know, engineering jobs and so on, and gradually there's a kind of dissemination spread of football. But the interesting thing to me is that football seems related to a very modern moment in European art history as well, because a lot of the football clubs are formed a time when modern art is really kicking off, you know, in sort of the beginning of the 20th century. And so that's why I think there's an interesting kind of link between the idea of newness and making it new and new societies. And football clubs are seen as part of that artistic sort of expression of a nation, as opposed to, say, you know, football clubs might have been born 50 years earlier.
And does that reflect itself in the street art of of Yugoslavia? Because one of the things you showed some pictures earlier, and we'll put one of them up on the podcast as an example, which is very non-British. It's not the sort of thing we do in this country. So are you saying that art reflects that difficult history, that fracture, and the kind of coming together of a new nation?
I mean, I think so, but also if you remember a lot of street art, in a way it's also a reflection of certain kinds of developments in popular culture, because, you know, there's not a lot of street art in the 60s and 50s in Yugoslavia, so a lot of it is actually born out of the ultra movement, which kind of gets going in the 80s, in the late 80s in Yugoslavia. But a lot of those ultras are inspired, of course, by British football firms, if you like, you know, the Intercity firm, Millwall, whatever, and like football hooliganism, and actually priding themselves that link. And yet the way in which it manifests itself in Yugoslavia is much more in terms of as an organisation. And so there's like a choreography of art, and also it's kind of related closely to the state. So a lot of the murals are sort of actually almost officially sanctioned. So it's not like you turn up your paintbrush and, like, you know, you get arrested. It's actually almost seen as part of civic building, civic pride, and so each neighbourhood in Zagreb has a Dinamo Zagreb mural, because that's how you connect to your city, our city, and so it's our Dinamo, Naša Dinamo, you know. So it's,
and they're tolerated, Paul. They're not seen like we would probably somewhat old-fashionedly see them as graffiti.
Mm.
Nothing wrong maybe with graffiti, but they're completely tolerated there. They are actually seen as something more than that.
I mean, the Bad Blue Boys in Zagreb were in a way a political force, because it's interesting, because when Croatia gains independence and Tudjman comes to power, first thing Tudjman wants to do is change the name of Dinamo Zagreb to Croatia Zagreb. And Dinamo fans, interestingly, actually resist this move. So it's actually because they want to keep the tradition of the name, they don't want to be changing the name to Croatia Zagreb. Tudjman wants to, you know, this is a Croatian club now. This is the emblem and mascot of Croatia on a global stage. And yet Dinamo fans actually started boycotting games, and there's some famous graffiti in Zagreb at the time which said, just after independence, it said, if Croatia was really free, Dinamo would be Dinamo and not Croatia. And it's a kind of interesting, i.e. not Croatia, in inverted commas, Croatia Zagreb. There's an interesting relationship to kind of the past, because the Tito period at the moment in Yugoslavia is seen as a kind of thing which is kind of, it's not official history anymore, and yet up until Tito's death it was official history.
Yes.
You know, up until Tito, and when Tito died, people were mourning, there was kind of tears, after Tito, we swear an oath to you, Tito, to continue your work of brotherhood and unity. 10 years later it's all falling apart, you know, in that time. And I think the interesting thing about the fandom, how that comes into it, is that you'd think that fans who are, you know, the Deep Bad Blue Boys, like, fought in the Homeland War against, you know, for Croatia, the Dinamo Zagreb Bad Blue Boys. And yet they sort of are against the president on this issue. And they're putting graffiti around the street on this issue, that they don't want their club changing names. So it's kind of quite a brave thing to do, a country which is kind of just establishing itself for the first time. And like, you've got a group of fans who are actually kind of resisting what they see as artificial name changing.
Yeah.
Because they feel that a club means something more to them in terms of a history than just an easy political, let's change, you know, Leningrad to Stalingrad, let's change, you know, Dinamo to Croatia, let's change, you know, it just feels false. And so it feels like a symptom for them of, like, oh, it's wrong in a way with sort of society. So there's kind of political dimension to fandom, I think, more, you know, it's interesting.
Unless you spend a lot of time out in Croatia, and what's your feelings and thoughts?
Well, I've been to that part of the world every year since 2005. So Paul spent a great deal of time in Zagreb. I've spent most of my time in and around Split, and I've never been anywhere in the world where there seems to be such a connection between football and the people in the city. And Split's just not a holiday resort. Split is a massive city, and it's an industrial city, despite all its connection with Diocletian, the Roman Empire, and all of that, and its beautiful position on the Adriatic coast. It's an industrial shipbuilding city, and I still don't fully understand how there can be such a connection. And this was maybe one of the questions that I've asked Paul earlier, how this connection between the people and the football club, how it manifests itself in daily culture, in street art, and all of that. It's just astonishing. It really is. I don't know whether you, Paul, can put finger on that.
No, it is. I mean, it's part of. I mean, literally part of the architecture and fabric of the city. So I mean, I think because, you know, one of the first things I noticed when I moved to Zagreb was everywhere there was graffiti about the owner. At the time, was a guy called Zdravko Mamic, who's now, I think, he's in Bosnia. He got sentenced to 6.5 years in prison, and he fled the country. And Dinamo fans were actually pretty much boycotting the games because he was the owner, and he was seen as like corrupting Croatian football, you know, sort of kind of mafiosi kind of sort of thing, and the idea of kind of, you know, crony capitalism, that sort of idea, and seen as just employing and taking money out of the city. So there is a very kind of very, you know, strong sense of what it means to be a city and football and in Croatia. And also it's a kind of extension, in a certain sense it's an extension of how do you identify yourself? How do you think of yourself after the war? In the war, everyone kind of identifies themselves with Croatia, you know, and then how do you carry on identifying yourself? And football, if you like, is a kind of extension of that.
Is this after the Homeland War?
After the Homeland War, yeah. And you know, what's called the Homeland War in Croatia, and it's the extension of that, so that we carry on that nation building and city building, and we carry on after the trauma also of war, of course, you know, and so it's an act of memorialisation. So a lot of the graffiti also is there are references to Vukovar, there are references to people who fell in war, there are references to kind of fans who fell in war. And in a way, Croatia, for instance, an example of Croatia, the story of two wars, because of the Second World War, the partisan war, if you like, the Tito against the occupying and fascist kind of alliances of Germany, Italy, and their own country, Croatia, Ustasha. In a way, that war is seen as less significant than the Homeland War, because the Homeland War is a war of liberation, whereas the partisan, or the monuments, if you like, to the partisan period, are sort of now seen as pro-Yugoslavia, a bit pro-Serbian, a bit pro-this, a bit pro...
Yeah.
Even though Tito himself is born in Croatia.
Yes, you know, of course,
in northwest of Croatia, you know, so, and but there was a sense in which there was a rewriting of the history books that's going on, and it goes on through football in the sense of, you know, how we present ourselves to the wider world.
But it's so recent, isn't it? I think that's the thing, and you can't avoid the difficult history, recent history of Yugoslavia. And you mentioned earlier during your talk about a significant event that took place between a match between Dinamo Zagreb and Red Star Belgrade in the Dinamo Stadium. So if you'd like to expand on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously tensions have been brewing because the...
And this is what, 1990?
1990, I mean, put it into a bit of context, we've got the sort of, you know, really Eastern Europe's kind of crumbling in the sense of the fall of the Berlin Wall, there's a kind of whole flux, political flux, if you like, ideological flux. And that flux obviously is also kind of, you know, recreated and played out in former Yugoslavia. And the actual Croatia, I think the first free elections took place 2 months before that game, where for the first time other parties than the Communist Party were allowed to sort of stand. And so there's a whole sense of that the Croatian Croats have voted a very nationalist kind of leader in. Serbia are doing likewise, even Milosevic, I think, is in Serbia. And so there's a whole kind of cocktail of elements that are coming together at that time. And so, you know, night trains are piling into Zagreb from Belgrade, full of the Delia, the kind of Red Star firm, hooligan firm, if you like, we call it in the British context, ultras of Red Star, coming into Zagreb. And obviously there's going to be clashes. You know, in this time, you know, Yugoslavia is falling apart. People are blaming each other. There's senses of paranoia all over the place. All sorts of things. There's a whole other context to that match, which I can't really go into, you know, because it would take me too much time to go into it at that time. But what happened fundamentally was there was a political riot, you know. I mean, okay, you're not politicising, just say, oh, it's just a load of idiots who have a load of Ganesh and whatever and start kicking each other. But, like, in another sense, it feels... think it felt very politicised, you know, it seemed politicised, and it's certainly been memorialised as political, even if it was a bunch of even if it was just a football riot. And so it becomes politicised in the art, it becomes Boban's fighting for Croatia that moment in time.
So the Boban story is obviously one of the players of Dinamo Zagreb.
Yeah.
Who attacked the vice president
of FIFA.
Which is he cantonar kicks or drop kicks a policeman, and that becomes the iconography of the Homeland War, at the start of the Homeland War.
Yeah.
And is there a statue to that, you said?
There's a statue outside, Maxima Stadium, which is by the Bad Blue Boys. And it's seen as a moment where almost, even though it's a mythology in a sense, because of course it's more complex reasons than just a football game to kind of cause these things, but because it happens in that time and it seems symptomatic of that moment in history, just like you suddenly, you know, you think, ah, that's a kind of, and then it gradually becomes a sort of urban mythology, you know, and so it gradually seeps into culture, where the war didn't start wherever it started, but it started at that stadium, even though the war officially hadn't started yet, you know, there was no war at that stage.
So that's memorialised in an actual statue, which I guess is officially condoned. And then you've got street art as well all over, like you said, all over Zagreb. And that street art in British eyes looks quite aggressive, really. It looks dangerous almost in our eyes. And yet it's art, isn't it? It's public art as well. So there must be a tension there in that.
I think it's like I was saying earlier, the interesting thing about art is that kind of sport is about struggle, you know, in some sense. It's what makes it quite unique is this idea of, I think it's kind of Greek word of agon, you know, antagonist, the idea of the other team, and the idea of that struggle as being part of how you define yourself as either a victim of other teams or the nations, or a kind of, you know, you're struggling to liberate yourself, become the champions, you know, this time next year we'll be millionaires, this time next year we'll be champions.
But in an English sense, in a British sense, but that sort of rivalries are actually fairly meaningless, aren't they? I mean, really, you know, if Bradford City win or lose this happening, really it's meaningless. But in Croatian and Yugoslavian and Serbian, it actually is not meaningless at all, is it? It's wrapped up in all this other stuff.
It's like Orwell maybe says, it's war minus for shooting, you know, it's an extension of that sense of tribalism, but on a more dangerous kind of way. But, you know, saying that, I wouldn't like to come here and do a talk on Leeds United.
No,
so
you wouldn't be allowed.
I wouldn't be allowed. So.
Paul, in a book that we both know very well, Jonathan Wilson's Football Behind the Iron Curtain, which I think was probably written now about 2003, 2004, 2005, something like that. I think he interviews Slaven Bilic and a few other people, and at that point there was maybe a slight movement towards opening up the borders to an old-fashioned Yugoslavian league, the argument being that they wouldn't then lose all their players and crowds would go up, so once again you would see Red Star playing Hajduk, Dinamo. I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think that's possible, or do you think...
In a kind of world of fantasy football, it's really exciting. I mean, because one of the things always exciting me is kind of games between, for instance, Partizan Belgrade and Dinamo Zagreb, you know, so it's I think at an aesthetic level it's very exciting, but obviously that in itself is now layered with so much, like Dave was saying, meaning all the way through, and in a sense sport is not always diplomatic, you know, it has this role that, you know, we play a match, we all shake hands, but sport can also start chains of events because the emotions and conflicts, that's why it's a very aesthetic thing, very, very kind of congealed.
Yeah.
You know, and I use the word congealed, you know, deliberately, you know, because referencing, it's very much seen as like us against them. And yeah, there are kind of all sorts of kind of instances of, like, you know, Djokovic reaching out to kind of, you know, people, but at the same time, these traumas are so recent. You know, Vukovar is so recent. You know, you don't start talking about Vukovar in bars in Croatia.
I understand.
And the same in the Serbian context. Again, it depends where, you know, where people are placed. And the history is is incredibly deep, and the troves are deep, and the healing process is kind of going on. And to say sport is part of the healing process, which you could argue if we said a United League, or we'll heal the world with a United League, I'm not so sure at this moment in time. But at the same time, maybe, you know, I don't know, you know, it could be kind of that's the thing which makes people realise that, oh, you know, we can build some other kind of idea.
It would
but
potentially
I don't think
be
there's
good.
Any love for an idea of a return to Yugoslavia in Croatia or in Serbia.
For football,
or in
it would potentially be good for simply football at that level.
Yeah.
So how strong is it? I mean, obviously, as a Croatian league, is it a strong league? Or is
it's
it?
Weak.
Yeah. But the national team are a very good side.
The national team, great side. The local league is weak. Again, it's part of the problem with which Croatian football fans rebel against and talk about and complain about is that within Croatia itself there's no support for the kind of infrastructure of football. The national team gets, you know, is the glory, is the Croatian nation, is the kind of ambassador to the world. You know, you saw in the World Cup Kolinda, the president, she's wearing a shirt, she's next to Macron, she's actually wearing the Croatian shirt. Davor Šuker's not, other people, all the dignitaries, they're just wearing it. And this is part of this iconography of Croatia kind of presenting itself to the world. But in terms of grassroots football, it's there's nothing. There's Dinamo, there's Rijeka, there's Split, big teams, but there's not really a kind of anything underneath, you know, that's going on.
Attendances are quite low, aren't they?
Very, very low. And funding and clubs go out of business, and you know, and it's seen as like, and there's not really. The National League is weak, and there's all sorts of reasons for that, which are kind of again to do with kind of, you know, reasons to do with capitalism rather than reasons to do with Croatia, or the reasons to do with broader economic trends in society and how people organise.
Just remind me, what's the population of Croatia?
Like 4 million people.
It's really small, isn't it? It's like West Yorkshire or Yorkshire about in the league. And so it's absolutely amazing that they still get to World Cup finals, outplay nations like England, for example. It's incredible that level of football and the technical ability of the players who come from probably all of the Yugoslavia. Where does that come from? Why is it that they are technically good footballers? Is there an intrinsic reason? Is there a coach himself? Is it a mindset?
It's in the Gemisht. The history of the Yugoslav thing is a complicated thing, because a lot of the war memorials, for instance, to Yugoslavia, there's a lot of brutalist art which I wasn't able to show today, unfortunately, for time reasons. And the actual Yugoslav structure, you could say, actually has created, because a lot of the generation, for instance, that went through to 98 were playing in the Yugoslavia team, say in 87 in the World Youth Championships in Chile, I think.
Which they won, didn't
which
they?
Which they won,
yeah.
And it was, and the 1990 Yugoslav team, I think, got to the quarterfinals of the World Cup and were beaten by Argentina. And then, of course, in 92, Yugoslavia don't play Denmark, I think, replaced, and Yugoslavia don't take part in the European
Championship.
That's
right, yeah.
And Denmark won.
Denmark
winning.
Won, actually.
Denmark won the Laudrup teams, I think.
But you've also got, of course, 1990, Red Star Belgrade win the European Cup.
And Bradford City beat them.
Yes, that's but a great historical moment. Bradford City play Red Star Belgrade in a pre-season friendly, I think it was July 1990, and beat them 2-1.
Yeah.
And then that season, Red Star go on to win the European Cup. So we could kind of... Leeds United like to champions of Europe. Perhaps we've probably got a better case.
Of course, Dinamo Zagreb beat Leeds United in 1967 Fairs Cup final. So there's a graffiti in Zagreb memorialising this cup victory.
Perhaps there should be graffiti in Bradford memorialising this victory.
Should be about these games. I think, it's.
But it's interesting that peak around 1990, 92, and then the country implodes, breaks apart. And yet still Croatia seems to be the one nation of the former Yugoslavia that does it well on an international stage compared to Serbia.
Tudjman saw sport as absolutely crucial to nation building, absolutely crucial to what it means to be a Croat, absolutely crucial to what it means to kind of as a kind of as what distinguishes Croatia from the rest of is sport, and particularly football. And it's interesting, I think Tudjman long time before he was president of Croatia, was actually chairman of Partizan Belgrade. So there's all sorts of interesting historical twists on this, but I can't go into at the moment. But like, and but the thing is that it was seen as like investment in a national team was seen as the, that's the way we define ourselves as a nation, you know, through that, you know, and nothing else in football.
Well, yeah, I think anybody in this country, we all know Croatia, perhaps through holidays, but from a sporting perspective, you can't think of Croatia, not think of the red and white checks, you know, the way the team has played in the European Cup. So it has worked.
Yeah.
It has worked, and, you know, compared to, say, Serbia, which has probably underperformed as a football nation.
There were 500,000 people on the streets of Zagreb. I know you talk about Bradford City in your book, it's about 100,000 people in Bradford,
FA Cup in 1900.
You know, Croatian team, imagine coming back to Zagreb, there's 500,000 people on the streets of Zagreb.
And what's the population of Zagreb?
Zagreb, look at 800,000 people living in Zagreb.
So small capital cities.
Yeah,
so, but just for like context, if you go, that's something like 80% of the actual population are on the
obviously
streets.
People are coming in, yeah, people are coming in from, but it is, and it, the pictures are kind of, you know, unbelievable. And it was, that's what it means. And it means, and I remember on the clubs, I have quite a lot of friends in Zagreb, and when Zagreb beat England in the semi-final, Croatia beat England in the semi-final. Friends saying, Paul, you don't realise we're crying because it means more to us. It's not just football. Paul, you don't realise it means more to us. And they're telling me this. These are good friends of mine. Yeah. We're crying. And then I've got pictures of friends sending me pictures on Messenger or whatever. And like, you know, there's somebody's in tears in the bar because it means it's about the homeland. It's about liberation, having had centuries of Austro-Hungarian rule or potentially being threatened by the idea of a new Serbian kingdom or something, you know. And so it means something beyond because of those historical details of occupation, of war, of and so in a way it's kind of a narrative of hope, it's a narrative of liberation. But of course, at the same time, it can also become a narrative of national, you know. And so it's always a fine line, those kind of.
So that probably explains an awful lot about the street art, why it's so different from here, the ultra movement, why it's so different to here, and why Croatia as a footballing nation is meaningful in a way that football is perhaps not as meaningful in Britain. It is, despite our passions about football, it is meaningless.
That is probably the answer to all those questions.
It's beyond life and death, as I said. In a way, it's beyond life and death, and that's the amazing thing about football. I mean, you know, Shankly gets quoted again and again on this. It's not a matter of life; it's more important. But in a sense, beyond life and death also means that somehow it embodies what it means to survive, to persist. So it sounds, you know, to kind of keep going, to grin and bear it, to suffer. And like, you know, people say, whatever you do, don't take the suffering of our people away from us. Because in a way, that also is how you identify yourself sometimes. I think football fans are aware of this. Football fans know what it means to suffer. And obviously, also, in certain cases, if it's in Zagreb, know what it means to die in Battle of very recently. And I think that idea, and that's why I think it is related to the art of modernism, the art of Picasso, the art of, which is like art which is talking about where things start breaking down after the First World War. During the terrible trauma of World War One, really influences the art that appears around that time. That art is no longer a nice, you know, a nice hall, everything's going up, a nice progressive narrative of life, you know. Suddenly there's fragmentation, fracture, antagonism, pain, all these things. And I think the street art and the memorialisations are a way of, a sort of way of healing, but also a way of kind of, you know, reminding you to never forget. And never forget who you are and where you are and where you come from. And there are conservative ways of looking at that, but also there are radical ways of looking at that, depending on the context. It's
fascinating stuff. Well, I think we're about to wrap that one up. Thank you, Les. Thank you,
Paul.
Had another great day at the Record Cafe.
Cheers, Dave.
And listen out next time. Thank you.